This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
Well, why don't we seek some more answers to our prayers and pray together. Lord, probably a lot of us are tired and our minds have been working over time. We pray that in this time you'd help us to focus on the right things. And I pray personally that you'd guide me to say what needs to be said and to leave out the stuff that doesn't need to be said. For the glory of Jesus Christ. Amen. Well, it's great to be here. I was not expecting the invite to come and talk to you about this because, as Gary's indicated, we are still very much in process, as we say. You say process, so there's going to be a lot of... I'm just going to stick to process because it's most natural for me. I have modified my accent over the years, because I do a lot of speaking through translation, different parts of the world. So, but some words just come out that way. So it's good to be here. I'm on the leadership team of Glen Abbey Church. I helped found the church in 1988. Glen Abbey had a rather unfortunate beginning, which I'll tell you about in a moment. So although the church started in that sense officially in 88, it started a long way further back than that. There's quite a religious heritage, which I'll explain a little bit to you. Northern Ireland is I suppose like everywhere else, it's a particular place, and it has a particular sense of humour, and perhaps you do need to understand the humour to understand the people. It was perhaps best summed up for me recently when someone told me the following story. Some of you may remember the Beirut hostages some years ago, and one of them was John McCarthy, who was an English journalist, and he was taken in Beirut, bundled into the trunk or the boot of a car, we call it the boot, into the trunk of a car and taken off into captivity and wasn't seen for some years. When he was released, eventually he came to Belfast. And the taxi driver, because they're extremely well educated in Northern Ireland, recognized John McCarthy when he was driving him from the airport into the center of Belfast. So he looked in the mirror at him, and with a twinkle in his eyes, he said, "You're that McCarthy fella, aren't you?" He said, "Yes, yes, yes, I am," using Clive Calver's accent. So the taxi driver said, "Would you not feel more comfortable in the trunk?" Now, that kind of illustrates the sort of dark humor. I suspect that it's born out of our history, to as national humor tends to be, and our history, as you are well aware, has not been a very pleasant one, certainly in recent times. Northern Ireland has been the sore toe of the West, 30 plus years of terrorism, which have left almost every family touched in some way, either a relative or a friend that we know. I've seen pupils in the school that I used to teach shot dead as policemen in Northern Ireland. My brother was blown up in the early 70s, lost an eye, nearly lost his life. It's left a major psychological scar in him. Most of us have experienced some of that, and it tends to color you in one way or another. Either you're reacting against it or you're going with it, and it's part of the fabric of Northern Ireland. And it's one of the things that perhaps, if this thing can stir into life, it's part of our context, and it's important that you understand just a little bit of that to know where it is we're working, and maybe why we do things the way they do them. So if we think of the context for a moment, the basic issue for us is that the political division in our country mirrors the religious division, and Protestantism has become chiefly associated with unionist politics. That is, they desire the aspiration to remain part of the United Kingdom. And that's strong chiefly amongst the so-called Protestant community. The result has been, of course, that because the strongest voice within Protestantism is evangelicalism in various shades, that the gospel has become identified with a political viewpoint. And that creates considerable layers of difficulty for us within our context. So it's something just to be aware of. At the same time, Roman Catholicism is identified chiefly with nationalism, that is the aspiration for a united Ireland, governed from Dublin. I'm one of those rare people who think that that's really the way it ought to go, despite my background. But that again means that somebody coming from a Roman Catholic background to trust in the message that the evangelicals preach means change of culture, a change of politics, a denial of personal identity. So it's a huge issue for us. Glenabbey Church is so called partly because we want to distance ourselves from that kind of association that most of the mainline denominations have with the political situation. Now, I'm not saying that there are no great churches, there are, but it's the perception. And it's a lot easier for folks to come from a whole variety of backgrounds to a Glenabbey-type situation than it is for them, say, to go to the local Baptist church, because that's identified with a particular brand of evangelicalism, which is identified with the political problem. So that's one of the issues. The other issue is one that you're very familiar with, and that is simply the rapid invasion of modern Western culture. Belfast has changed beyond all recognition. When I was a student in the early 70s, just before the flood, I could sit up in the library of the university and watch bombs go off over the city and hear the gunfire, and that was just almost a daily occurrence in the early 70s. There was only one restaurant in the street that led from the university down to the center of the town, of the city. Now that area is just covered with restaurants and cinemas, and Friday night, Saturday night in particular, it's just a throng of young folks in search of a good time. So there's just been a sudden, almost like into the vacuum created by years of tension, the peace process, such as it is, has resulted in part, at least, in this kind of sudden hedonistic binge. If you read something like Patrick Johnson's Operation Worlds, now I haven't seen the most recent edition, so I'll have to check that. But it always gives the impression that Northern Ireland is almost entirely, you know, Christian and everybody goes to church. That is changing rapidly. Church attendance used to be very high on both sides of the community, but it's just plummeting. Presbyterian Church, which is still probably the largest Protestant denomination on its own statistics, will cease to exist in the year 2025. Now, of course, statistics don't tell the whole story. There are churches that don't fall in line with those trends, but it just shows how serious. And a lot of church leaders are actually not bothering to do anything about that because they've discovered it's a lot easier simply to go with the flow, especially when you're over 50 and retirement is coming on. So Glenabbey is a little bit different, but it has been marked by all of those things. It arose from the ashes of a painful church division and a church that I also helped to start. And it resulted in a group of about 25 adults huddling together to keep warm, to tend each other's wounds. It wasn't the ideal raw material for church planting. And that the church survived at all is a tribute to what God has done. Certainly not any human ingenuity on our part. And now, 16 years later, we have a family of around 600 adults, young people and kids. Still essentially a young church, although there are increasing numbers of people who are blessed with white hair and the wisdom that goes with that. But one of the benefits in our situation was the freedom to reconsider New Testament teaching on church. Because we're not tied to any particular denomination, we're able to do that. At the same time, Glenabbey came out of largely a Christian Brethren stable. Now, does that mean anything? The Brethren Church? It does to Patrick. He's also from Northern Ireland, so he knows a little bit about that. It's hard to sum it up, really. Strong belief in the priesthood of all believers, but that's translated as the priesthood of some of the men. It's very kind of narrow, frequently extremely legalistic type of church background. So it's traditional in that sense, not in the sense of the one solo pastor, because in the Brethren background, you do not use the word pastor. And they, you know, they shun supposedly all professionalism, etc. But very traditional in its mindset, with its legalism, with its programmed approach to doing church. And what we would call New Testament community, which of course needs unpacked and defined, but what we would probably agree to being New Testament community, simply did not exist and wasn't even looked for. You went to a meeting, meeting over, you went home. End of story. That was it. And that tradition is quite strong across the churches. So we've had to really do a lot of thinking, and I'll come to that as we go through. Initially, of course, all we were was a home church, because that's what we met at home, that was it. But there was no home church philosophy, home group philosophy. Our idea then was we grow this group, we get a building, we get a bigger building, we get a bigger building. And so that was the process we went through. And then we added a Wednesday night Bible study, Sunday morning worship and teaching service, children's meeting, youth meeting, prayer times, mission support program. And then, thanks to the influence of the United States, we introduced men's ministry and women's ministry, each with their own separate programs. And then as part of the mix, we decided we need home groups as well. So we fired home groups in there. You know, every good home should have one, just like every good home needs a fridge. And these groups, they served a useful purpose. I mean, none of these things was bad. You know, it's no heresy. They're bad things in themselves. Lots of good stuff happened in these. So don't get the impression I'm knocking all of that. But there was kind of competition for bodies and competition for airtime. And I wasn't really quite sure what we were doing. And that's just typical of a lot of churches in Northern Ireland. I suspect it's quite typical of a lot of churches in North America as well. And the type of home group, what people think of when they think home group in Northern Ireland generally, is a neighborhood Bible study that sometimes studies the Bible. But often we'll have a social time, often we'll have a missionary come in and do a missionary report. You sit at the start of the year, you look at your calendar and you say, what are we going to do that night, what are we going to do there? And we fill our calendar, we phone people up, get them to come in and do the speaking, and we organize a program, and we sit back and we run the program. And that's generally what folks think in terms of home group. Now, a lot has changed in Glenabbey, but I have to say that we had three incarnations of home group, because this is on the basis that if you do certain things and it doesn't work, you should do them again with greater enthusiasm. And if that doesn't work, you do them again with even greater enthusiasm. So it just took us a little while to realize that this wasn't going to work, and it never would work, and radical change was required. So from September 01, which is less than 3 years ago, we entered our current process. So we reckon it's going to take at least 5 years for some of the core principles to become ingrained in Glenabbey life. And we're only part the way through this process. And so I've kind of taken time out in the middle of it to come and tell you what we've learned so far. I can't present any finished product to you. I'm not here as an expert in church growth or home groups or whatever. There is a kind of pragmatic fixation, I think, in the West, where if you could write a book with the five keys to successful home group ministry. I don't know if there's one such book written, but it'll sell. Stuart Briscoe once told me that if you write a book with a number in the title in America, it will sell. I have written a book, but I kept a number out of the title, so it won't sell, but there you go. But it kind of reflects that almost idea that there are eight keys, and if you just program them into the computer of church, press a button, then you'll produce biblical community. Now, I suspect you all know it doesn't work, but it's extremely tempting. So please don't understand what I'm going to say as that kind of thing. I'm going to mention 10 things very briefly, and I describe them as discoveries, because they're discoveries for us. They're not new by any means, but for us they're things that we have uncovered. Maybe they should have been uncoveries. Is there such a word? Things that we have uncovered in the process through. We started with 8 home groups in September 01, just to give you the bare statistics. We had 8 home groups in September 01. This has now grown to 13. It would have been 14, except that the home group that I was leading had to be blown up. As Gary reminded me, I'm the leader in failure in our church. It's a good place to be, because people see, well, if it didn't work out for him, then okay, well, we can have a go at this. But there were a lot of reasons for that, and one of them was a moral issue that had to be confronted at leadership level, which meant that we just really had to fold the home group up and get folks into other groups. And they all went into other groups, and that has been largely a good thing. That represents about 50% of our regular adult attendees. So that's what we've got to, around about 200 people, adults. 7 of those groups are running single gender small groups, small cells, arising out of the home groups. In addition to that, we have completely remodeled youth ministry to reflect that same pattern, because we reckon that the reality is that adults are not the easiest folks to change their minds about things. And once they're set in a particular way of thinking, it really is quite difficult and can almost be counterproductive. There are certain battles that are really not worth fighting, others that are, and you have to learn to choose your battle. But if at youth level in particular, and the level of the students, we can get this into the lifeblood of the church, in 10 years' time, these folks will be leading the church. So it'll be there. You need really to take a longer term view. Just before I came away, 2 adults came to faith in association with one of the new home groups, and that was just so exciting. The last year has been the most fruitful year for us in terms of evangelism. I think there's over 50 folks have come to know Christ. Children, young people, adults. That's more than in the first 15 years of our existence as a church. So that's been exciting. Of course, it also reflects the fact that for many years, the folks who came to Glen Abbey and built it up were people who were burnt out, disillusioned in other churches and so on. And we have served a useful function there, because a lot of people would just have been lost to the kingdom of God. It's not always a bad thing when people transfer for the right reasons. And it's been wonderful to see even some folks who have been missionaries who are just burned out and disillusioned. We have picked them up and looked after them, and we've got them back into Christian ministry. So that's part of it. It's not all. I don't want to give the impression that it's all been through revival evangelism. There is a CD by Robin Mark that some of you may have seen called Revival in Belfast. People keep asking me about it, and I just want to assure you that as far as I'm aware, there is no revival in Belfast. That was a marketing ploy, not by Robin Mark, but by the music company. They thought it would sell, and they were right. Of course, it deserves to sell. The music's nice. Ish. All right. The 2 biggest challenges for us, and I haven't put this on the handout, but just to summarize the whole thing, the 2 biggest challenges for us have been one at the conceptual level and the other at the leadership level. Those 2 things, if I was to sum it all up, that's That's the biggest challenge. By the conceptual level, I mean really understanding the New Testament vision of what church should look like, particularly in its relational life and its spiritual growth, you know, its outreach, the whole thing. What does it mean to be a church? That's what I'm talking about. And that's a big fight. And I come back to that, to get an agreed understanding, to get that clear in folks' minds. The second thing is at leadership level. Most people are like computers. They come with a factory setting. And no matter how many new programs you put on, there's always a temptation to hit a button, you know, reboot back to the default settings. And if people have had a prior experience of church and a prior experience of home group, it is extremely difficult for them to move out of that. And we just have to be realistic. If you're seeking to transition your church in some way, you will have to face this, that often you will use the same language and mean totally different things. And when that happens at leadership level, then really, you know, no group is going to grow beyond its leaders, really. Sometimes it happens and the leaders recognize it and move out of the way, but most of the time it doesn't happen. So that's a big a challenge. So what were the steps that we took? Well, what I'm going to do is to weave the practical actions into the 10 discoveries. Now, I'm sure there are about 97 discoveries, but here's 10 of them. Please feel free to interrupt at any time.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are handouts. Did people get handouts?
Did you want them handed out at the end?
I did. So if you got the handout, just ignore it. I hope there are enough. If they're not, we can get the 10 points are on the handout. So, it's my old teaching background. You always give the handouts out at the end, unless it's a particular type of handout like Phil used in his group, where you have to write on during it, and that's okay. So, key discoveries. Number one, transition will not take place effectively. Sorry about that. That looks very strong language. Will not take place effectively. But I don't mean it to sound like that. Will not take place effectively without the development of strong biblical conviction. This is at that conceptual level. We didn't do enough work here. And we regretted it. And we still regret it. People need to be taught about the New Testament church. I really do. And I'm talking now particularly at leadership level. Even at my own level, as I suppose the key kind of visionary person, I needed to come to a point where I had very clear biblical convictions of the type of church that we wanted to be and work that through with the elders. Without that, you see, the thing is, I suppose it's a bit like a marriage. If mom and dad are not committed to one another, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, etc., etc., then the first sign of trouble, you know, you run for cover. And it's the same in church life, really, because it gets hot in the kitchen of church ministry and leadership. And unless there's a very clear biblical conviction that this is right, I'm not talking about the structure now. Structures, that's in a different level, but the vision of biblical community, unless we're clear that this is right and this is what pleases the Lord, then I think when it gets tough, we'll look for alternatives. So that is absolutely critical. And for us, of course, and for me personally, that came out of a lot of study of passages, particularly Ephesians 4. That was central for us, because the vision Paul paints there of a body that matches the head, if I can put it that way. I mean, it's just phenomenal to think that Christ is the head and we are the body, and the body is to grow to a point where it matches the head. It's a body worthy of this head. It's a phenomenal vision. And when I looked, you know, at what we were doing, it reminded me of one of these cartoons, you know, with a huge head and this wee tiny stick body underneath it. And that vision that Paul has there of growing towards unity in the faith. Man, that's, how many churches do you know who are like that? You're actually in that process of growing towards unity in the faith, in the objective truth. A lot of places just leave that to the pastor. But to have a church growing there, to have it being built, this body being built by that which every part is supplying, it's just not happening. It's a kind of professionalism that creeps into Christian ministry. And again, we leave all that to the guys who are paid to do it. So this is very radical and in terms of where the church in Northern Ireland is. That's not radical. It's obvious in the New Testament. It's part of our calling and who we are, but it is radical. So that was, and vision tends to emerge out of dissatisfaction with the status quo. And that dissatisfaction can be a holy thing. Sometimes it's just lack of contentment and so on. But it's a holy thing when it's a response to the vision that God has given us in his word. And it's important to respond to that. So that's the first issue. And I encourage you to keep developing that, because it's an ongoing process. And connected to that is transition will not take place effectively without the development of strongly shared biblical conviction at leadership level. If you've only got one person, i.e. you, who's convinced of this is going to be a hard thing. It's not impossible, but it's going to be hard. If you have your core leadership team who share the conviction, you multiply your chances of success exponentially. And it's not a stage that can be rushed. I did not sit down and write out, here's the blueprint, this is what we're doing, okay? Everybody agree? Fine, let's do it. People don't understand it first time. I didn't. Still probably don't understand it all. So it needs time for the development. And church members are instinctively experts at divide and conquer tactics with leaders. They'll come and they'll ask Gary, what's the elder's view on X? And then they'll go and ask, you know, Dennis, what's the elder's view on it? And they go to someone because they're looking for a chink in the, that's not what Gary said. You guys don't know what you're doing, do you? So people do that instinctively, because we learn to do that as kids with our mom and dad. So, you know, we just do it instinctively. So we got to work really hard at leading. And we aren't there yet in Glen Abbey. We're not there yet. We're a long way of the way towards it, but we're not totally there. And that creates all kinds of issues for us. So that's the second thing. Do you want me to stop, or do you want me just to fire on and Q&A at the end? Just keep going? Okay, right. Number three, transition will not take place unless claimed convictions are demonstrated in the engagement of core leaders in the process. That's just a long way of saying that if your key leaders aren't involved in it, it doesn't mean a thing. What they say doesn't mean a thing. I mean, you could have the most gifted senior pastor in the world expounding wonderfully on the dynamics of Christian community, but if he's not personally engaged in it, it doesn't mean anything. Actions speak more loudly than words on this one. So that's a big issue. There's got to be credibility. And claim convictions. I don't know how many times in the past I've given talks about the importance of personal evangelism, dreading somebody coming and asking me, well, when are you going to do some? You know, it's like a bald-headed man trying to sell hair restorer. It just doesn't work. So, again, that's important. And each of our elders in Glen Abbey is involved in home group. They're not each leading a home group, but they're each involved in it. And that is a major statement of how important we see this to be in our life. And that, again, wasn't always the case. Number four, transition needs to be supported through consistent teaching and envisioning of the whole church. If this really is the vision, then we need to teach it, support it, teach it consistently. I did a teaching series on Philippians, for example, talking about the kind of the fellow workers, all that emphasis on unity, oneness of mind, working together, and so on. We use Gary's excellent little book, Loving God's Way, and We taught some out of that to the whole church. We have used it at small group level, home group level. We taught on New Testament models of church, Jerusalem, Antioch, Ephesus, etc. We organized conferences that highlighted that this is what we're doing. We're intentional about this. Not everybody bought into it. That's okay. This is where we're going. Gary was gracious enough to come and help us with that. And that was useful because, you see, it gives you somebody else to blame. You know, sometimes a guy will come in and say, you know, these outlandish things that he says, and we can come along, yeah, but that's just Gary. I mean, you know, it's... So that was helpful, but it stimulates the thinking. And it helps. I do want to emphasize, we are not attempting to become Zenos Mark II in Northern Ireland. And it is not motivated by that. It's motivated by a vision emerging out of the New Testament. And then finding like-minded people who have been there a little bit longer than us and have something to teach us and share. But you will find that Glen Abbey is not the same as Zenos. There are lots of differences. I haven't time to go into them, but there are lots of differences. That's okay. I mean, they'll learn they're wrong. But vision leaks, as Bill Hybels keeps repeating, and you just need to keep stoking the fires of this biblical view of what Christian community means. Number five, transition causes less fallout when it's allowed to develop incrementally rather than being imposed all at once. On these things, evolution generally rather than a revolution. Now, of course, having said that, there are certain situations that really there's nothing you can do. And this is a hard one. Each situation has to be judged on its own merit. But we have churches in Northern Ireland which will die and need to be allowed to die. My life is too short to shore up something that's got no future. And I'm always struck by what Jesus says to the church in Ephesus. You know, guys, you got this chance to repent. If you don't, I'm going to remove your lampstand. I suspect they maybe functioned for a while, you know. But that's serious stuff. The being a lampstand in the world, those images are not chosen at random. It's carrying light in the world. So Paul talks about in Philippians 2. And that is such a key thing, that if we stop being light in our world through the love we share in the reality of community, then God just closes us down. So, it's his church after all, isn't it? Not ours. And there's more at stake here than offending somebody's pride. So, we did a very silly thing. We did loads of silly things. But on one occasion, we tried to impose home groups on the whole church. We got a list of all the members and regular attendees. And we spent hours as an eldership team deciding which groups everybody would go into. Now, there are at least 20 reasons why that wasn't a good idea. But, you know, experience is a hard school, but fools will learn in no other, as they say. So we learned from that. So you got to take it slow. In our situation at the minute, we've got maybe three or four groups that are really have got a hold of what it is we're trying to do. There's some others that are kind of halfway there. There's some I don't think ever will get there, and they'll probably just have to be allowed to go through their natural course and die and be reconstituted. That's okay, at least as we see it. At least there's good practice, there are good models being developed, and we're learning as we go. But the gradual evolution, the growing up in our understanding, and certain things now are accepted as normative, which were controversial 2 years ago. And that's the way it goes. And you need to work, I think, like that. Okay, number six. Transition will sometimes require the closing down of existing programs. The good is often the enemy of the best. This really is a hard one. thanks to me and my early visits to the U.S., we introduced men's ministry and women's ministry, as I said. So what we are basically saying to people was when they came through the doors of Glen Abbey, men go this way, women go the other way. And when we realized that that's what we were doing, we said, okay, let's add home groups to that so that they'll go one way and then the other way, and then we'll have a situation where they're going to all come together. Trouble is that there are only so many hours in the day. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with men's ministry. There's nothing wrong with women's ministry. But in our situation, there was too much competition, and we weren't getting a central message across of what we were really about. But again, this is where the evolution comes in. We sit down with the leaders of the ministries and begin to explain to them what it is we're seeking to do. We phased out men's small groups over a period of 2 years. We sought to incorporate the best practice of those groups into our home groups. We developed men's groups out of our home groups so that there are now men's small groups, except that they're now part of the core strategy of the church and not a little ministry out here on its own. And we've done the same thing with women's ministry. We do have a number of activities just for women during the day and the occasional conference. That's fine. That's great. It's very beneficial. We had Jill Briscoe over with us recently at a wonderful day for the women on prayer. 250 women from the church showed up. Had a great time. That's great. But the core of it is getting folks together in and through the home group. So sometimes you have to take those hard decisions. And again, as they say, there's more at stake here than offending somebody's pride. We have, over the 16 years, had to close down every single ministry in the church. Now, that's hard. But if we're going to get where we needed to go, but we didn't usually do it in one, you know, blow everybody up. Although we just have done that effectively with missions. Starting again from scratch, basically. It was interesting. One living example was with our children's work. This will interest Kathy, because we had a kind of traditional children's Sunday school approach. Sunday school doesn't mean the same in Northern Ireland as it does here. It's not. There's no adult Sunday school in the UK. It's just children, Sunday school's kids, okay? And the leader of the Sunday school told us that, no, nobody wanted to teach with the kids. Nobody really wanted to get involved. We had only 13 people involved. And, you know, and that was the way it was. And So in the end, we just had to close it down. There now, I think it's approaching 90 adults involved in children's work. And that only took about a year to happen because the structure was wrong, the attitudes were wrong, the character was wrong. And at the end of the day, you can skirt around it, you can work, you can cajole, and you must do those things. But in the end, we just had to say, no, we can't do this. I'm sorry, but we need to move on. So we did. Number seven, transition requires the development of an increasingly biblically trained and spiritually experienced workforce. And this really is relating particularly onto to the leadership side. We got to the point where there was something profoundly unethical, really, about what we were doing. If you had a pulse and a bit of enthusiasm and been a Christian for a while, you can do children's ministry. You know, you can take a youth Bible class if you can hold the Bible the right way around. And that mentality is endemic in the church. And it comes out of a false understanding of what the priesthood of all believers means. I haven't time to go into that, but we had to challenge that. And that's been a painful process, really has been a painful. What, you mean I need trained? What are you saying? I've been a Christian for 25 years and nobody ever told me I needed to. Of course, you don't have people like that in America. I know that. They're just in Ireland, so... The other thing that we did, and partly it was good, but partly it threw up other things, was We used the networking program from Willow Creek. That's very helpful for folks to sit down and try to understand their makeup and what they're called to do. But it takes more than an identification of gift to qualify somebody for service. And the way we did it, I'm sure it wasn't the intention of Mr. Bugby and whoever else wrote the book, but the way we did it created an expectation that if you do the network program and discover that you've got a teaching gift, you'll be teaching next week. Because that's your gift. And if you've got the gift, you've got to use it. But it just doesn't work like that. And we had to kind of go, hey, you know, let's step back. And here, Zenos was particularly helpful to us because in the model of the Christian principles classes, we introduced a basic course for everybody in service. Indeed, we went as far as to say that if you do not do this course, we will have to step you out of ministry until you've done it. Now, you can imagine how that goes down. I thought this was a grace-based church, and that's been a hard one. That course is designed around teaching Romans for half of the course so that you know, they could follow kind of an inductive, systematic study of Romans, at least so that we could agree what the gospel was, what the basic method of sanctification was, and what Christian community should look like. We left out Romans 9, 10, 11 because we don't understand it. the other half of the course was basic ecclesiology. You know, the difference between Old Covenant and New Covenant, how that affects the shape of church, and lots of stuff in there. And that's been very helpful. But, of course, the classroom is not enough. It's only part of the picture. And there's a danger, of course, in creating a kind of box-ticking mentality. Well, I've done the course. Yeah. So there's a lot of other things involved. But at least it was a beginning. It was another one of those things. And we've introduced additional courses, very, you know, strongly Bible-based courses called Getting the Message. So we do Getting the Message Philippines, Getting the Message Ruth, Getting the Message, you know, and these are five-week courses that get folks involved in the, you know, personal study of a book of the Bible. And it's just amazing how much training goes on in the Christian church that kind of leaves the Bible as a reference book on the side. And we have discovered that in Northern Ireland. I don't know, again, you need to comment about here. But 2 Timothy 3, 16-17, profound words. You know, that scripture, through scripture, the man and woman of God will be equipped for every good work. Do we really believe that? That Ezekiel is part of the equipping process for spiritual ministry. So I've got a few courses still to take before I'm fully equipped. But that's the kind of ethos, that's the kind of vision. And of course, the mentoring and discipling and all of that come in here. And again, that's part of it. I haven't time to talk about it. Number eight, this is part of a transition requires entrusting more and more spiritual ministry to developing leaders. I was involved in Pioneer evangelism, discipleship when I was 19. I was an elder in a church when I was 24. Too young to be an elder in a church. But I look at 19-year-olds now, and because I'm 51, my temptation is they don't know anything. And I need to be careful that I don't get crusty and old-fashioned and my arteries get hard as I get older. In Northern Ireland, we are afflicted by professionalism of the wrong kind in Christian ministry. It's sort of the pastor syndrome. Do you have that here? Where I'm not quite sure where it's come from. I keep encouraging Gary to write a book on this, on leadership and deal with this. But whether it comes, you know, from the background of Judaism and ritualism, whether it comes out of tribalism or big business or whatever, but this kind of picture of the holy man who does everything and the rest of us, wow. What does the priesthood of all believers mean? You know, what do the gifts mean? What does body life mean, if that's the way it is? To give you an illustration, I mean, I think this has been imported by mission to all corners of the world, unfortunately. I have a good friend who is an attorney, a very senior figure in the courts in Northern Ireland. He's also an excellent Bible teacher, and he travels with me. And we were in Africa doing some Bible teaching, and I was no problem to them because I'm a pastor. Even though I didn't tell them that I'm basically a high school teacher with a degree in French. But he's a lawyer. What's a lawyer doing with a Bible in his hand? So, yeah, it is. I mean, you just... But there's that kind of thing. So he wasn't asked to speak at the main services. But I was. Not on the basis of them having heard us teach, but on the basis of a built-in bias that really sees it that the pastor is, you know. So that tends to afflict the church more than perhaps we realize. It has been so exciting to recognize the tendencies for this in ourselves. And, for example, to say, no, the elders are not going to do the baptizing. You know, let the home group leaders and the folks who've brought these people to Christ, let them do it. It's just transformed our baptism nights. We dunk people because there's no crocodiles. It just transforms it. Instead of this kind of holy figure getting into the swimming pool, it's just the most natural thing in the world, and it's joyful and it's liberating, and people just sense that privilege. I've been involved in affecting the eternal destiny of another human being. This is so special. So that's part of it, and we need to learn to do that. 9, transition requires organizing church around what is core. And you know, this is a kind of Act 6 situation where you don't allow the urgent to take you away from what is strategically important in the long haul. We have had to change everything in church life, basically. Not the gospel, but the way we do stuff in order to make this biblical vision of New Testament church an increasing reality. There's probably no area of church life that hasn't been affected in some ways. And just a couple of examples. We have started to put our best leaders into home groups. We didn't used to do this. Home group was just another program. And, well, if you're no good at preaching and you're no good at music and you're no good at youth work, well, you can lead a home group. And that is very often the mentality. So that had to change. We raised the profile of home group leadership so that now at our annual leadership retreat, all the home group leaders come to that. They've never done that before. But so what we were saying was that the person who's in charge of drama is of more significance than you if you're leading a home group. That's just ridiculous. So, you know, you recognize that in yourself. You say, this is crazy. This needs change. So we changed it. And these are the little steps that we have to take. And as I said earlier, youth ministry has become the key for us. Until 2 years ago, youth ministry in Glen Abbey was very event-focused. It was basically an entertainment service, a babysitting service, under pressure from parents in particular. If you introduce the Bible in this youth group, my Johnny won't come. We have had conversation after conversation with parents like that. Unbelievable. So we said, well, the unfortunate thing is that the New Testament mandate is that we have got to make disciples. Now, you know, if you want to disagree with the Lord, that's okay, but we're not going to. So we focused it on discipleship, and the difference is just astounding. I don't know how to describe it. I suppose we might have had 15 people 2 years ago who are showing up at the youth meetings. Now we have 120 teenagers involved in youth home groups. I mean, that's just staggering in our context. And, of course, one of the things that does is it drives leadership down, gives more people opportunities to emerge. It gives an outlet for our college-age young folks to serve in a significant way. And, you know, we've discovered, lots of others have discovered, but young people, when they're treated seriously, often will respond seriously. And because I did. First person who treated me seriously, didn't happen until I was 16, and just talked to me about spiritual things and prayed with me. First time it happened in my life, changed my life, because somebody took me seriously. So when we do that with young folks and believe that they have a contribution, that they can reach their friends and all of that, well, the Xenoids here know all about that. But, you know, we're learning, and that's just been stunning. And that will change the landscape of Glen Abbey beyond recognition. So a lot of the fights, you know, at adult level, really, in a sense, are unnecessary, because the church is changing from within. We're seeing good stuff happen with the adults, as I've said, but the real core of it is coming through the youth. And over the next 5 to 10 years, that'll be remarkable. Finally, folks, discovery number 10. The transition will not last unless there's a strong outreach focus and an emphasis on self-replication, both of the group and of the individual. And that's been hammered home. I heard Dennis talk about this a couple of years ago. Gary has spoken about this. And it's just the reality that churches are like gardens or yards, as you call them here. Left to themselves, they just go to seed. You know, the weeds grow up and it chokes the evangelism out. And unless you keep it front and center, it disappears. Starting the way you mean to progress is extremely important. Letting folks know that this is what this is about. We're learning about this. But it needs to be there. Otherwise, we'll just have self-focused Christian ghettos, which will self-destruct. And we have done that 3 times, so we don't need to do it again. And it's just irrelevant. One exciting story, a friend, Stephen, he's a 30-year-old businessman. I don't know, I'm not quite sure how we got into conversation, but we started to talk and we discovered a shared interest in Douglas Copeland novels, or Copeland, how do you pronounce his name here? Generation X, all that stuff, yeah. We started to talk about, he was amazed that a Christian actually read a book. I mean, that was stunning. And we started to talk, he had a Christian background way years ago, throwing the whole thing over. And we started to talk and we just shared stuff together. And he made lunch appointments and so on. He went on a road trip to the U.S. And in the course of that road trip, he committed his life to Jesus Christ, surrounded by a bunch of drunk pagans. I mean, it was just amazing, totally amazing. The Lord brought him just to the end of all that, and he trusted Christ. Well, Stephen, of course, the big challenge, integrating into a church. What a horrible idea. So he started to come, and he actually enjoyed Sunday morning because the music was contemporary, the teaching was relevant. But this community thing scared him. But at my encouragement, he started to go to the suitable home group. But at that stage, the home group had kind of hit a glass ceiling. Nobody was being real about anything. There would be a Bible study, but when it was over, people would talk about sport, music, you know, anything but the Lord, anything about than what was going on in their lives. Very few people were sharing their faith, etc., etc. Then some folks left the group. And they went to another group, and that group appears to be going the right direction. It's just a change of dynamics. They changed the night of the group. David Mayers, who leads the group, that some guys here know, he had been constantly challenging folks about their spiritual life, and just it was almost as if a switch had been thrown, and people started to get serious. Cells were formed. Stephen, I asked him what's made the difference, because for him, as a new believer coming out of just almost complete paganism, he found a bunch of people who were being real, who were talking about real problems, and he started then to talk to one of his friends. And that was one of the guys who trusted Christ last week. Sorry. It's just fantastic to be involved in it. So those are some of the things anyway that we have discovered in our way through. Questions? Questions? Yes, sir.
You said that transition has to be evolutionary rather than revolutionary.
I said it's generally it's wiser that way. But it's not always possible to do it like that.
But when you you started this, or if you were to start over again, what kind of timetable do you think you would use with your context?
Wow. Hindsight is 20/20 vision, as they say. So I don't know that I could answer the question, because I think that for us, the process we've been through was necessary. We needed to learn, and in some things, you know, it obviously took us longer to learn than we ought to have taken. But that was the way that the Lord has kind of chipped away at us and changed us. I would hate to be prescriptive about timetables, and if I was starting again, I would know certain things that I would do differently. I wouldn't compromise on the qualities of leaders. I mean, any time we have done that has been a disaster. There is a level, I mean, all leadership is a risk when you entrust people with responsibility, but there's an acceptable risk and there's an unacceptable risk. We put people into positions thinking, well, I think maybe they've got some kind of, let's try it. And we knew in our hearts it wasn't going to work, but such was the pressure. I mean, there's one time when I was beginning to understand this a little bit better, and the elders wanted to start home groups up again. I said to them, look, could you give me a year, even 6 months, with a group of the people that you want to be leaders? Let me do home group with them for at least 6 months, and then start this. And they said, no, we've got to start it now. People are wanting groups. We've got to. So I was overruled, and okay, let's go. It was a disaster. It failed again. But at the same time, we learned that it was a disaster and it wouldn't work, and we had to. So that's one of the things that we would change if we were doing it again. But as the time scales, I think every place is different. Do you want to comment, Gary, on time?
I remember when we talked first in 2000 that I was really struck and impressed that, you know, the Lord had realism. Mm-hmm. This has got thoroughgoing change, mm-hmm. ethos and everything, and that you got the elders, the key people were on board for mm-hmm. a long term. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Phil.
Excellent job.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's loaded with wisdom there. Thanks for presenting that. My question is, do you find that making these changes has made any kind of difference in further breaking down like sectarian outreach and the willingness maybe for more people with a Catholic background to come into a home group or something like that? Any effect there at all?
It's too early to say. Yeah. We have a number of folks who come from a Roman Catholic nationalist background. So that's encouraging. There are other things that divide the society. The education is segregated. So that is still a major difficulty for us to get over. I think how I see that is that we are facilitating the possibility for folks to come in and integrate into the community of the church with fewer and fewer problems and questions attached, but certainly no claims to this is the answer to Northern Ireland. Not yet, we're not there, but I mean, it's a great thing just to keep focused, and I've been reading some of John Perkins' stuff since I've been here. I hadn't come across him before, even though he's been to Ireland a few times. And it has made me think about that, the kind of divisions in our country. They are different, but there are certain similarities. And I would like to be able to tell you in 5 years' time, Phil, that we're seeing real inroads being made here. But again, I think it's more likely to happen probably at student level, because that's when the groups come together. Universities are not separate, so that's probably the key area where it'll happen.
Is Glen Abbey an actual church building?
Gilbert, looks like a church.
Yeah, repeat the question. Is Glen Abbey an actual church building? Yes. Do you mean, do we have a church building?
Yes.
We have a warehouse, sanctified. it used to be a place where people came to hire tractors and, you know, plant and so on. So we bought it over, and there are quite a few mobile huts, and or we call them mobiles. I don't know what you call them here. Portable buildings. They're not very portable, but they're made out of wood. They're temporary structures. It's a bit like a shanty town, you know, in South Africa. Somebody once said it looked as if a large aircraft had exploded in the sky and just fallen all in the one parking lot. It's not particularly, you know, architecturally stunning. So nobody will be coming to Glen Abbey because of the aesthetics. But that's, again, for folks coming from a Roman Catholic background in particular, it doesn't look like a Protestant church.
Well, that's why. I had originally been Catholic.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
That you're not walking in a church building and where it's got the pews and all that stuff. Where, you know, you walk in and people are listening to a teaching, drinking coffee, and eating bagels. It kind of relaxes them immediately as far as you get the message across better as to what is actually important.
Sure, that's right. And I have to tell you now, this is sort of hot off the press, that we are the only church building in Ireland that serves Starbucks coffee. Hey, that's spiritual growth right there. Yes.
I'm sorry, you probably already said this. I came in late. This group that you're in now, is that the one you started in where you were an elder, like, you know, when you were 24?
No, I've been involved in church planting since I was about 19, and so this is the third church that I've helped to start up, and this is the one I've stayed in longest.
So, you've been there for how long?
Well, Glen Abbey started in 1988, so I've been there since the beginning. Yes?
I know there have been other breakout sessions on the strong outreach focus for home groups, and our situation is that we are just in the initial stages of doing home groups, and so we are training leadership.
Yes.
Our pastor is taking that year and training leaders, but our outreach is nil as leaders.
Yeah.
I'm very involved in an outreach, but it seems unnatural to me that just because these leaders are in a home group with me that they ought to be required to do my outreach. Mm-hmm. How does that evolve naturally? Is that something you can speak to? How does outreach evolve in a home church?
It's not really something that I could talk about with a great deal of authority. I would prefer that Phil or Gary handle that, because, I mean, we're a bit like yourselves, you know. We're just starting. We're beginning to see some stuff happening. We're having a conference in October where Mark Green from the London Institute of Contemporary Christianity is coming over to talk to us about the relevance of the marketplace of daily work and ways in which we can become more effective witnesses and outreach in that context. So we're beginning. We had Gary address the issue of developing an outreach ethos in the church. Trying to change the climate of people's thinking, because in our situation, evangelism means a mission run by the church, where Billy Graham's replacement comes in and a big music team, and, you know, that's fine, except it doesn't work anymore in our context. So to get folks to understand that this is about life style. This is about building relationships and sharing Jesus with folks in the context of daily life. Yes, adding some activities in that facilitate the contact. But once you've done that, it's basically life on life, sharing the story. That's going to take us a long time to get that through.
So is what I'm hearing that maybe the outreach focus of a home church becomes what each person does individually, as opposed to how a home church organizes themselves to collectively make an impact in the community?
I don't think it's either or.
It's got to be both. Right?
Yeah, it's got to be both.
You know, Gary? Patch is doing a workshop on leading, called?
Leading Home Group Evangelism.
And it's really good.
I think it's right now.
Bob, but you get the tape.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And the Roos are doing one on lifestyle evangelism. But Doug's is really focusing not just on how can home groups throw outreach events, but this whole issue of inculcating the value that as a lifestyle we share Christ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Where I'm serving, it's a long tradition of the divine service being the central focus, and so far as that, I believe if you didn't have the divine service Sunday mornings, you'd have a few bills to pay, an occasional Bible study, and nothing else. And I don't know if you face this, you know, but if you were you're talking about in number nine, organizing the church around what is core. What if you're dealing with an extremely long tradition of a church where the core is merely the divine service? The Sunday morning, and that's it, and you're trying to tell them, really, okay, maybe we've been wrong for 1,500 years.
Well, I wouldn't tell them that.
But, I mean, did you deal with that, and how did you deal with that?
Well, I've had to deal with it in other circumstances, not so much in Glen Abbey, but in other church situations. I mean, you don't have to make that the center of your life. You know, in that sense, I mean, if worse comes to the worst, there is no power on earth that can stop you being a witness and working with folks and so on a kind of unofficial level. I did that for years. When I first started a discipleship program in the traditional church I was brought up in, I was told to, you know, shut this down, but it happened to be not on church property, and I said, well, thank you for your opinion, but this really doesn't come under your remit. I grew a beard, which was absolute sin. I see you have one, so you need repentance. I'm sure I was a little hot-headed, and I'm not encouraging that kind of mindless hot-headedness. But my kind of spiritual mentor for many years constantly repeated to me, he used to say, Gilbert, you need to be free to obey the Lord. That's what I would say. You need to be free to obey the Lord. And that doesn't necessarily mean leaving the church you're in or having an all-out fist fight with the senior pastor or whatever. Yeah, that's you. If you are the senior pastor, well, let's have a conversation afterwards, I think.
More options.
Yes, there are more options, yeah. You have more options then. Yeah.
I guess I'm concerned about, well, you had mentioned too that long-term people where you maybe almost have to, it's almost easier to give birth than to raise the dead.
Yes, yes.
How do I go to God's people and say, you've been doing this for 70 years, and I honestly don't think this is the core of what we should be doing. I mean, it's not relational in any way. Mm-hmm. It's detrimental to your faith. I mean, I honestly feel it's detrimental to your faith because it created a compartmentalization of your faith.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if you faced that. You said not so much there, but...
Yeah. One general comment I would make is that I wouldn't attack it primarily at a structural level. I would attack it at a theological, you know, at the level of your teaching and what you're sharing. Yeah, yeah. So those are the kind of things I would do. I think there are some examples in the States where folks have reduced their church down to, you know, I think Dave Johnson did this at Church of the Open Door in Minneapolis. I think it went down to about 16 or something. And now has several thousand in it. Just, he preached them out.
Dennis McCallum, one of the other founders of the church, I've heard him advocate in situations like that. is that the staff guy, the pastor, goes and starts some small thing mm-hmm. off here to the side, lets it be successful and right-headed and theologically correct, and you know, after you get a convert or two in there and they begin to grow, then there's actually Exhibit A to show the rest of the church. Not only are you preaching the theology, but you can say, and here's how it works over here. You know, and when people begin to hear the testimonies of these new converts over here in this little satellite group, I mean, it'll ring true in flesh and blood.
Yeah. So you know, in that sense, you don't have to change everything that's there, but you can add something new that is then gradually going to perhaps even consume the other and change it.
I just want to add, I sense that I've been a little bit on the same journey in the sense that I've always been in traditional churches and I was preaching. And so you always had to do the traditional programs, and if you want to start a small group ministry, you're on your own. And that's frustrating, but if you can get a group that's going well to be the exhibit, then you have more of a, I guess, an argument, if you want to put it that way, to do that. But people have to see it, that there's something other than what they're doing mm-hmm. that can actually be more effective.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, I think for the traditional church, I'm the same position you are. They just spent $1 million to restore the sanctuary. You know? So that's where they're focused.
Yeah.
You know, I think what's going to happen, what I am, we're going to have two tracks, probably for a long time, particularly 75% of the church is over 65 years old. Mm. Well, they're going to die.
Yes.
You know, that may be the only way.
Yes.
But... probably
going to
have both and for a long while.
Yeah. And certainly quite a few of my friends who are in that situation in Northern Ireland, that's precisely what they've done. Of course, in certain church traditions, they move their pastor or senior minister around. I mean, the Methodists in our context move them every 4 years. So it's almost as if you're saying, look, the minister will change, but we will remain the same forever, you know. So, it's there are other additional complicating factors there. Yeah. I think we're coming to an end, unless there's another burning question. Thank you so much for staying awake. That's very encouraging. and God bless you. Thank you.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.